"Don't you know?" said Lazzaroline. "He's here, of course. He came to town yesterday, and is asking about you everywhere. And to think of you and me being here together, and his not knowing anything about it. It's the funniest thing I've ever heard." And she went off into giggles. She always had been a terrible giggler, as Aravis now remembered. "It isn't funny at all," she said. "It's dreadfully serious. Where can you hide me?" "No difficulty at all, my dear girl," said Lazzaroline. "I'll take you home. My husband's away, and no one will see you." "Phew! It's not much fun with the curtains drawn. I want to see people. There's no point in having a new dress on if one's to go about shut up like this." "I hope no one heard you when you shouted out to me like that," said Aravis. "No, no, of course, darling," said Lazzaroline absent-mindedly. "But you haven't even told me yet what you think of the dress." "Another thing," said Aravis. "You must tell your people to treat those two horses very respectfully. That's part of the secret. They're really talking horses from Narnia." "Fancy," said Lazzaroline. "How exciting. And, oh, darling, have you seen the barbarian queen from Narnia? She's staying in Tashban at present. They say Prince Rabadash is madly in love with her. There have been the most wonderful parties and hunts and things all this last fortnight. I can't see that she's so very pretty myself, but some of the Narnia men are lovely. I was taken out on a river party the day before yesterday, and I was wearing my... How shall we prevent your people telling everyone that you've got a visitor dressed like a beggar's brat in your house? It might so easily get round to my father. Now don't keep on fussing, there's a dear," said Lazzaroline. "We'll get you some proper clothes in a moment. And here we are."
The bearers had stopped, and the litter was being lowered. When the curtains had been drawn, Aravis found that she was in a courtyard garden, very like the one that Shasta had been taken to a few minutes earlier in another part of the city. Lazzaroline would have gone indoors at once, but Aravis reminded her in a frantic whisper to say something to the slaves about not telling anyone of their mistress's strange visitor.
"Oh, sorry, darling, it had gone right out of my head," said Lazzaroline.
"Here, all of you, and you, doorkeeper. No one is to be let out of the house today, and anyone I catch talking about this young lady will be first beaten to death and then burned alive, and after that be kept on bread and water for 6 weeks. There."
Although Lazzaroline had said she was dying to hear Aravis's story, she showed no sign of really wanting to hear it at all. She was, in fact, much better at talking than at listening. She insisted on Aravis having a long and luxurious bath. Calormine baths are famous. And then dressing her up in the finest clothes before she would let her explain anything. The fuss she made about choosing the dresses nearly drove Aravis mad. She remembered now that Lazzaroline had always been like that, interested in clothes and parties and gossip. Aravis had always been more interested in bows and arrows and horses and dogs and swimming. You will guess that each thought the other silly. But when at last they were both seated after a meal, it was chiefly of the whipped cream and jelly and fruit and ice sort, in a beautiful pillared room, which Aravis would have liked better if Lazzaroline's spoilt pet monkey hadn't been climbing about it all the time, Lazzaroline at last asked her why she was running away from home. When Aravis had finished telling her story, Lazzaroline said,
"But, darling, why don't you marry Ahoshta Tarkan? Everyone's crazy about him. My husband says he's beginning to be one of the greatest men in Kalorman. He has just been made Grand Vizier now old Aksatha has died. Didn't you know?" "I don't care. I can't stand the sight of him," said Aravis. "Oh, but darling, only think. 3 palaces, and one of them that beautiful one down on the lake at Ilkin. Positively ropes of pearls, I'm told. Baths of ass's milk. And you'd see such a lot of me." "He can keep his pearls and palaces as far as I'm concerned," said Aravis.
"You always were a queer girl, Aravis," said Lazzaroline. "What more do you want?"
In the end, however, Aravis managed to make her friend believe that she was in earnest, and even to discuss plans. There would be no difficulty now about getting the two horses out of the north gate and then on to the tombs. No one would stop or question a groom in fine clothes leading a war horse and a lady's saddle horse down to the river, and Lazzaroline had plenty of grooms to send. It wasn't so easy to decide what to do about Aravis herself. She suggested that she could be carried out in the litter with the curtains drawn. But Lazzaroline told her that litters were only used in the city, and the sight of one going out through the gate would be certain to lead to questions. When they had talked for a long time, and it was all the longer because Aravis found it hard to keep her friend to the point. At last, Lazareline clapped her hands and said,
"Oh, I have an idea. There is one way of getting out of the city without using the gates. The Tizrock's garden, may he live forever, runs right down to the water, and there is a little water door. Only for the palace people, of course. But then you know, dear," here she tittered a little, "we almost are palace people. I say, it is lucky for you that you came to me. The dear Tizrock, may he live forever, is so kind. We're asked to the palace almost every day, and it is like a second home. I love all the dear princes and princesses, and I positively adore Prince Rabadash. I might run in and see any of the palace ladies at any hour of the day or night. Why shouldn't I slip in with you after dark, and let you out by the water door? There are always a few punts and things tied up outside it, and even if we were caught,
all would be lost," said Aravis.
"Oh, darling, don't get so excited," said Lazareline. "I was going to say, even if we were caught, everyone would only say it was one of my mad jokes. I'm getting quite well known for them. Only the other day—do listen, dear, this is frightfully funny. I meant all would be lost for me," said Aravis a little sharply.
"Oh, yes, I do see what you mean, darling.
Well, can you think of any better plan?"
Aravis couldn't, and answered,
"No, we'll have to risk it. When can we start?"
"Oh, not tonight," said Lazareline. "Of course not tonight. There's a great feast on tonight. I must start getting my hair done for it in a few minutes, and the whole place will be a blaze of lights. And such a crowd, too. It would have to be tomorrow night."
This was bad news for Aravis, but she had to make the best of it. The afternoon passed very slowly, and it was a relief when Lazareline went out to the banquet. For Aravis was very tired of her giggling and her talk about dresses and parties, weddings and engagements and scandals. She went to bed early, and that part she did enjoy. It was so nice to have pillows and sheets again. But the next day passed very slowly. Lazareline wanted to go back on the whole arrangement and kept on telling Aravis that Narnia was a country of perpetual snow and ice, inhabited by demons and sorcerers, and she was mad to think of going there.
"And with a peasant boy, too," said Lazareline. "Darling, think of it. It's not nice."
Aravis had thought of it a good deal, but she was so tired of Lazareline's silliness by now that for the first time she began to think that travelling with Shasta was really rather more fun than fashionable life in Tashban. So she only replied,
"You forget that I'll be nobody, just like him, when we get to Narnia. And anyway, I promised."
"And to think," said Lazareline, almost crying, "that if only you had sense, you could be the wife of a grand vizier."
Aravis went away to have a private word with the horses.
"You must go with a groom a little before sunset down to the tombs," she said. "No more of those packs. You'll be saddled and bridled again. But there'll have to be food in Huynh's saddlebags, and a full water skin behind yours, Bree. The man has orders to let you both have a good long drink at the far side of the bridge."
"And then Narnia and the North," whispered Bree.
"But what if Shasta is not at the tombs?"
"Wait for him, of course," said Aravis. "I hope you've been quite comfortable."
"Never better stabled in my life," said Bree. "But if the husband of that tittering Tarquina friend of yours is paying his head groom to get the best oats, then I think the head groom is cheating him."
Aravis and Lazareline had supper in the pillared room. About 2 hours later, they were ready to start. Aravis was dressed to look like a superior slave girl in a great house, and wore a veil over her face. They had agreed that if any questions were asked, Lazareline would pretend that Aravis was a slave she was taking as a present to one of the princesses. The two girls went out on foot. A very few minutes brought them to the palace gates. Here there were, of course, soldiers on guard, but the officer knew Lazareline quite well, and called his men to attention and saluted. They passed at once into the hall of black marble. A fair number of courtiers, slaves, and others were still moving about here, but this only made the two girls less conspicuous. They passed on into the hall of pillars, and then into the hall of statues and down the colonnade, passing the great beaten copper doors of the throne room. It was all magnificent beyond description, what they could see of it in the dim light of the lamps. Presently they came out into the garden court, which sloped downhill in a number of terraces. On the far side of that they came to the old palace. It had already grown almost quite dark, and they now found themselves in a maze of corridors lit only by occasional torches fixed in brackets to the walls. Lazareline halted at a place where you had to go either left or right.
"Go on. Do go on," whispered Aravis, whose heart was beating terribly, and who still felt that her father might run into them at any corner.
"I'm just wondering," said Lazareline. "I'm not absolutely sure which way we go from here. I think it's the left."
"Yes, I'm almost sure it's the left.
Oh, what fun this is!"
They took the left-hand way and found themselves in a passage that was hardly lit at all, and which soon began going down steps.
"It's all right," said Lazareline. "I'm sure we're right now. I remember these steps."
But at that moment, a moving light appeared ahead. A second later, there appeared from round a distant corner the dark shapes of two men walking backward and carrying tall candles. And, of course, it is only before royalties that people walk backward. Aravis felt Lazareline grip her arm, that sort of sudden grip which is almost a pinch, and which means that the person who is gripping you is very frightened indeed. Aravis thought it odd that Lazareline should be so afraid of the Tisrock if he were really such a friend of hers. But there was no time to go on thinking. Lazareline was hurrying her back to the top of the steps, on tiptoes and groping wildly along the wall.
"Here's the door," she whispered. "Quick!"
They went in, drew the door very softly behind them, and found themselves in pitch darkness. Aravis could hear by Lazareline's breathing that she was terrified.
"Dash preserve us," whispered Lazareline. "What shall we do if he comes in here? Can we hide?"
There was a soft carpet under their feet. They groped forward into the room and blundered onto a sofa.
"Let's lie down behind it," whimpered Lazareline. "Oh, I do wish we hadn't come."
There was just room between the sofa and the curtained wall, and the two girls got down. Lazareline managed to get the better position and was completely covered. The upper part of Aravis's face stuck out beyond the sofa, so that if anyone came into that room with a light and happened to look in exactly the right place, they would see her. But of course, because she was wearing a veil, what they saw would not at once look like her forehead and a pair of eyes. Aravis shoved desperately to try to make Lazareline give her a little more room, but Lazareline, now quite selfish in her panic, fought back and pinched her feet. They gave it up and lay still, panting a little. Their own breath seemed dreadfully noisy, but there was no other noise.
"Is it safe?" said Aravis at last, in the tiniest possible whisper. "I think so," began Lazareline. "But my poor nerves..."
And then came the most terrible noise they could have heard at that moment. The noise of the door opening. And then came light. And because Aravis couldn't get her head any further in behind the sofa, she saw everything. First came the two slaves, deaf and dumb, as Aravis rightly guessed, and therefore used at the most secret councils, walking backward and carrying the candles. They took up their stand, one at each end of the sofa. This was a good thing, for of course it was now harder for anyone to see Aravis once a slave was in front of her, and she was looking between his heels. Then came an old man, very fat, wearing a curious pointed cap, by which she immediately knew that he was the Tisrock. The least of the jewels with which he was covered was worth more than all the clothes and weapons of the Narnian lords put together. But he was so fat and such a mass of frills and pleats and bobbles and buttons and tassels and talismans that Aravis couldn't help thinking the Narnian fashions, at any rate for men, looked nicer. After him came a tall young man, with a feathered and jewelled turban on his head, and an ivory-sheathed scimitar at his side. He seemed very excited, and his eyes and teeth flashed fiercely in the candlelight. Last of all came a little hump-backed, wizened old man, in whom she recognised with a shudder the new Grand Vizier and her own betrothed husband, Ahoshta Takan himself. As soon as all three had entered the room and the door was shut, the Tisrock seated himself on the divan with a sigh of contentment. The young man took his place standing before him, and the Grand Vizier got down on his knees and elbows and laid his face flat on the carpet. Chapter 8. In the House of the Tisrock. "Oh, my father, and oh, the delight of my eyes! began the young man, muttering the words very quickly and sulkily, and not at all as if the Tisrock were the delight of his eyes. "May you live forever, but you have utterly destroyed me. If you had given me the swiftest of the galleys at sunrise, when I first saw that the ship of the accursed barbarians was gone from her place, I would perhaps have overtaken them. But you persuaded me to send first, and see if they had not merely moved round the point into better anchorage. And now the whole day has been wasted, and they are gone, gone out of my reach, the false jade, the—" And here he added a great many descriptions of Queen Susan, which would not look at all nice in print. For, of course, this young man was Prince Rabadash, and, of course, the false jade was Susan of Narnia.
"Compose yourself, O my son," said the Tisrock, "for the departure of guests makes a wound that is easily healed in the heart of a judicious host."
"But I want her," cried the prince. "I must have her. I shall die if I do not get her, false, proud, black-hearted daughter of a dog that she is. I cannot sleep, and my food has no savour, and my eyes are darkened because of her beauty. I must have the barbarian queen."
"How well it was said by a gifted poet," observed the vizier, raising his face in a somewhat dusty condition from the carpet, "that deep draughts from the fountain of reason are desirable in order to extinguish the fire of youthful love."
This seemed to exasperate the prince.
"Dog!"
he shouted, directing a series of well-aimed kicks at the hindquarters of the vizier.
"Do not dare to quote the poets to me. I have had maxims and verses flung at me all day, and I can endure them no more."
I am afraid Aravis did not feel at all sorry for the vizier. The Tisrock was apparently sunk in thought, but when, after a long pause, he noticed what was happening, he said tranquilly,
"My son, by all means desist from kicking the venerable and enlightened vizier, for as a costly jewel retains its value even if hidden in a dunghill, so old age and discretion are to be respected even in the vile persons of our subjects. Desist, therefore, and tell us what you desire and propose."
"I desire and propose, O my father," said Rabadash, "that you immediately call out your invincible armies and invade the thrice-accursed land of Narnia, and waste it with fire and sword, and add it to your illimitable empire, killing their high king and all of his blood except the Queen Susan. For I must have her as my wife, though she shall learn a sharp lesson first."
"Understand, O my son," said the Tisrock, "that no words you can speak will move me to open war against Narnia."
"If you are not my father, O ever-living Tisrock," said the prince, grinding his teeth, "I should say that was the word of a coward."
"And if you are not my son, O most inflammable Rabadash," replied his father, "your life would be short and your death slow when you had said it."
The cool, placid voice in which he spoke these words made Aravis's blood run cold.
"But why, O my father," said the prince, this time in a much more respectful voice, "why should we think twice about punishing Narnia any more than about hanging an idle slave or sending a worn-out horse to be made into dog's meat? It is not the fourth size of one of your least provinces. 1,000 spears could conquer it in 5 weeks. It is an unseemly blot on the skirts of your empire."
"Most undoubtedly," said the Tisrock. "These little barbarian countries that call themselves free, which is as much as to say idle, disordered, and unprofitable, are hateful to the gods and to all persons of discernment.
Then why have we suffered such a land as Narnia to remain thus long unsubdued?"
"No, O enlightened prince," said the Grand Vizier, "that until the year in which your exalted father began his salutary and unending reign, the land of Narnia was covered with ice and snow, and was moreover ruled by a most powerful enchantress." "This I know very well, O loquacious Vizier," answered the prince, "but I know also that the enchantress is dead, and the ice and snow have vanished, so that Narnia is now wholesome, fruitful, and delicious."
And this change, O most learned prince, has doubtless been brought to pass by the powerful incantations of those wicked persons who now call themselves kings and queens of Narnia.
I am rather of the opinion, said Rabadash, that it has come about by the alteration of the stars and the operation of natural causes.
All this, said the Tisrock, is a question for the disputations of learned men. I will never believe that so great an alteration and the killing of the old enchantress were effected without the aid of strong magic, and such things are to be expected in that land which is chiefly inhabited by demons in the shape of beasts that talk like men, and monsters that are half man and half beast. It is commonly reported that the High King of Narnia, whom may the gods utterly reject, is supported by a demon of hideous aspect and irresistible maleficence, who appears in the shape of a lion. Therefore the attacking of Narnia is a dark and doubtful enterprise, and I am determined not to put my hand out farther than I can draw it back.
How blessed is Calormen, said the vizier, popping up his face again, on whose ruler the gods have been pleased to bestow prudence and circumspection. Yet, as the irrefutable and sapient Tisrock has said, it is very grievous to be constrained to keep our hands off such a dainty dish as Narnia. Gifted was that poet who said—
But at this point Ahoshta noticed an impatient movement of the prince's toe, and became suddenly silent.
"It is very grievous," said the Tisrock in his deep, quiet voice. "Every morning the sun is darkened in my eyes, and every night my sleep is the less refreshing, because I remember that Narnia is still free."
"Oh, my father," said Rabadash, "how if I show you a way by which you can stretch out your arm to take Narnia, and yet draw it back unharmed if the attempt prove unfortunate?"
"If you can show me that, O Rabadash," said the Tisrock, "you will be the best of sons."
"Hear then, O father. This very night and in this hour I will take but 200 horses and ride across the desert, and it shall seem to all men that you know nothing of my going. On the second morning I shall be at the gates of King Lune's castle of Anvard in Arkenland. They are at peace with us and unprepared, and I shall take Anvard before they have bestirred themselves. Then I will ride through the pass above Anvard and down through Narnia to Caer Paravel. The High King will not be there. When I left them, he was already preparing a raid against the giants on his northern border. I shall find Caer Paravel, most likely with open gates, and ride in. I shall exercise prudence and courtesy and spill as little Narnian blood as I can. And what then remains but to sit there till the splendour Hyaline puts in with Queen Susan on board, catch my strayed bird as she sets foot ashore, swing her into the saddle, and then ride, ride, ride back to Anvard?"
"But is it not probable, O my son," said the Tisrock, "that at the taking of the woman either King Edmund or you will lose his life?"
"They will be a small company," said Rabadash, "and I will order 10 of my men to disarm and bind him, restraining my vehement desire for his blood, so that there shall be no deadly cause of war between you and the High King."
"And how if the splendour Hyaline is at Caer Paravel before you?"
"I do not look for that with these winds, O my father."
"And lastly, O my resourceful son," said the Tisrock, "you have made clear how all this might give you the barbarian woman, but not how it helps me to the overthrowing of Narnia."
"O my father, can it have escaped you that though I and my horsemen will come and go through Narnia like an arrow from a bow, yet we shall have Anvard for ever? And when you hold Anvard, you sit in the very gate of Narnia, and your garrison in Anvard can be increased by little and little, till it is a great host."
"It is spoken with understanding and foresight. But how do I draw back my arm if all this miscarries?"
"You shall say that I did it without your knowledge, and against your will, and without your blessing, being constrained by the violence of my love and impetuosity of youth."
"And how if the High King then demands that we send back the barbarian woman, his sister?"
"Oh, my father, be assured that he will not.
For though the fancy of a woman has rejected this marriage, the High King Peter is a man of prudence and understanding, who will in no way wish to lose the high honour and advantage of being allied to our house, and seeing his nephew and grand-nephew on the throne of Calormen. He will not see that if I live forever, as is no doubt your wish, said the Tisrock in an even drier voice than usual.
And also, O my father, and O the delight of my eyes, said the prince, after a moment of awkward silence, we shall write letters as if from the queen to say that she loves me and has no desire to return to Narnia. For it is well known that women are as changeable as weathercocks, and even if they do not wholly believe the letters, they will not dare to come to Tashban in arms to fetch her.
O enlightened vizier, said the Tisrock, bestow your wisdom upon us concerning this strange proposal.
O eternal Tisrock, answered Ahoshta, the strength of paternal affection is not unknown to me, and I have often heard that sons are in the eyes of their fathers more precious than carbuncles. How then shall I dare freely to unfold to you my mind in a matter which may imperil the life of this exalted prince?
Undoubtedly you will dare, replied the Tisrock, because you will find that the dangers of not doing so are at least equally great.
To hear is to obey, moaned the wretched man. Know then, O most reasonable Tisrock, in the first place, that the danger of the prince is not altogether so great as might appear, for the gods have withheld from the barbarians the light of discretion, as that their poetry is not, like ours, full of choice apothegms and useful maxims, but is all of love and war. Therefore nothing will appear to them more noble and admirable than such a mad enterprise as this of—
Ow! For the prince, at the word mad, had kicked him. Desist, O my son, said the Tisrock, and you, estimable vizier, whether he desists or not, by no means allow the flow of your eloquence to be interrupted, for nothing is more suitable to persons of gravity and decorum than to endure minor inconveniences with constancy.
To hear is to obey, said the vizier,
wriggling himself round a little so as to get his hinder parts further away from Rabadash's toe.
Nothing I say will seem as pardonable, if not estimable, in their eyes as this, hazardous attempt, especially because it is undertaken for the love of a woman. Therefore, if the prince by misfortune fell into their hands, they would assuredly not kill him. Nay, it may even be that though he failed to carry off the queen, yet the sight of his great valour and of the extremity of his passion might incline her heart to him.
That is a good point, O babbler, said Rabadash, very good, however it came into your ugly head.
The praise of my masters is the light of my eyes, said Ahoshta. And secondly, O Tisrock, whose reign must and shall be interminable, I think that with the aid of the gods it is very likely that Anvard will fall into the prince's hands, and if so, we have Narnia by the throat.
There was a long pause, and the room became so silent that the two girls hardly dared to breathe. At last the Tisrock spoke. "Go, my son," he said, "and do as you have said. But expect no help nor countenance from me. I will not avenge you if you are killed, and I will not deliver you if the barbarians cast you into prison. And if, either in success or failure, you shed a drop more than you need of Narnian noble blood, and open war arises from it, my favour shall never fall upon you again, and your next brother shall have your place in Calormen. Now go, be swift, secret, and fortunate. May the strength of Tash the Inexorable, the Irresistible, be in your sword and lance.
To hear is to obey, cried Rabadash,
and after kneeling for a moment to kiss his father's hands, he rushed from the room. Greatly to the disappointment of Aravis, who was now horribly cramped, the Tisrock and Vizier remained.
O Vizier, said the Tisrock, is it certain that no living soul knows of this council we three have held here to-night?
O, my master, said Ahoshta. "It is not possible that any should know. For that very reason I proposed, and you in your wisdom agreed, that we should meet here in the old palace, where no council is ever held, and none of the household has any occasion to come."
"It is well," said the Tisrop. "If any man knew, I would see to it that he died before an hour had passed. And do you also, O prudent vizier, forget it. I sponge away from my own heart and from yours all knowledge of the prince's plans. He is gone without my knowledge or my consent, I know not whither, because of his violence and the rash and disobedient disposition of youth. No man will be more astonished than you and I to hear that Anvard is in his hands."
"To hear is to obey," said Ahoshta.
"That is why you will never think even in your secret heart that I am the hardest-hearted of fathers who thus sends my first-born son on an errand so likely to be his death, pleasing as it must be to you who do not love the prince, for I see into the bottom of your mind."
"O impeccable Tisrak," said the vizier, "in comparison with you, I love neither the prince, nor my own life, nor bread, nor water, nor the light of the sun."
"Your sentiments," said the Tisrok, "are elevated and correct. I also love none of these things in comparison with the glory and strength of my throne. If the prince succeeds, we have Arkenland, and perhaps hereafter Narnia. If he fails, I have 18 other sons, and Rabadash, after the manner of the eldest sons of kings, was beginning to be dangerous. More than 5 Tisroks in Tashban have died before their time because their eldest sons, enlightened princes, grew tired of waiting for their throne. He had better cool his blood abroad than boil it in inaction here. And now, O excellent vizier, the excess of my paternal anxiety inclines me to sleep. Command the musicians to my chamber. But before you lie down, call back the pardon we wrote for the 3rd cook. I feel within me the manifest prognostics of indigestion."
"To hear is to obey," said the Grand Vizier.
He crawled backward on all fours to the door, rose, bowed, and went out. Even then the Tisrok remained seated in silence on the divan, till Aravis almost began to be afraid that he had dropped asleep. But at last, with a great creaking and sighing, he heaved up his enormous body, signed to the slaves to precede him with the lights, and went out. The door closed behind him, the room was once more totally dark, and the 2 girls could breathe freely again. Chapter 9. Across the Desert.
"How dreadful! How perfectly dreadful!" whimpered Lazareline. "Oh, darling, I am so frightened. I'm shaking all over. Feel me."
"Come on," said Aravis, who was trembling herself. "They've gone back to the new palace. Once we're out of this room, we're safe enough. But it's wasted a terrible time. Get me down to that water gate as quick as you can."
"Darling, how can you?" squeaked Lazareline. "I can't do anything. Not now. My poor nerves. No, we must just lie still a bit and then go back."
"Why back?" asked Aravis.
"Oh, don't you understand? You're so unsympathetic!"
cried Lazareline, beginning to cry. Aravis decided it was no occasion for mercy.
"Look here!"
she said, catching Lazareline and giving her a good shake. "If you say another word about going back, and if you don't start taking me to that water gate at once, do you know what I'll do? I'll rush out into that passage and scream. Then we'll both be caught."
"But we shall both be killed!" said Lazareline. "Didn't you hear what the Tisrok Mihil forever said?"
"Yes, and I'd sooner be killed than married to Ahoshta. So come on."
"Oh, you are unkind," said Lazareline, "and I in such a state."
But in the end she had to give in to Aravis. She led the way down the steps they had already descended, and along another corridor, and so finally out into the open air. They were now in the palace garden, which sloped down in terraces to the city wall. The moon shone brightly. One of the drawbacks about adventures is that when you come to the most beautiful places, you are often too anxious and hurried to appreciate them, so that Aravis, though she remembered them years later, had only a vague impression of grey lawns, quietly bubbling fountains, and the long black shadows of cypress trees. When they reached the very bottom and the wall rose frowning above them, Lazareline was shaking so much that she could not unbolt the gate. Aravis did it. There at last was the river, full of reflected moonlight, and a little landing stage, and a few pleasure boats.
"Goodbye," said Aravis, "and thank you. I'm sorry if I've been a pig, but think what I'm flying from."
"Oh, Aravis, darling," said Lazareline, "won't you change your mind, now that you've seen what a very great man Ahoshta is?"
"Great man," said Aravis, "a hideous grovelling slave who flatters when he's kicked, but treasures it all up and hopes to get his own back by egging on that horrible Tisrock to plot his son's death. Faugh! I'd sooner marry my father's scullion than a creature like that." "Oh, Aravis, Aravis, how can you say such dreadful things? And about the Tisrock, may he live forever, too. It must be right if he's going to do it." "Goodbye," said Aravis. "And I thought your dresses were lovely. And I think your house is lovely, too. I'm sure you'll have a lovely life, though it wouldn't suit me. Close the door softly behind me."
She tore herself away from her friend's affectionate embraces, stepped into a punt, cast off, and a moment later was out in midstream with a huge real moon overhead and a huge reflected moon down, deep down in the river. The air was fresh and cool, and as she drew near the farther bank, she heard the hooting of an owl.
"Ah, that's better,"
thought Aravis. She had always lived in the country, and had hated every minute of her time in Tashban. When she stepped ashore, she found herself in darkness, for the rise of the ground and the trees cut off the moonlight. But she managed to find the same road that Shasta had found, and came just as he had done to the end of the grass and the beginning of the sand, and looked, like him, to her left, and saw the big black tombs. And now at last, brave girl though she was, her heart quailed. Supposing the others weren't there, supposing the ghouls were. But she stuck out her chin, and a little bit of her tongue too, and went straight toward them. But before she had reached them, she saw Bree and Hwin, and the groom.
"You can go back to your mistress now,"
said Aravis, quite forgetting that he couldn't until the city gates opened next morning.
"Here is money for your pains."
"To hear is to obey,"
said the groom, and at once set off at a remarkable speed in the direction of the city. There was no need to tell him to make haste. He also had been thinking a good deal about ghouls. For the next few seconds, Aravis was busy kissing the noses and patting the necks of Hwin and Bree, just as if they were quite ordinary horses.
"And here comes Shasta. Thanks be to the lion," said Bree.
Aravis looked round, and there, right enough, was Shasta, who had come out of hiding the moment he saw the groom going away.
"And now," said Aravis, "there's not a moment to lose."
And in hasty words she told them about Rabadash's expedition.
"Treacherous hounds," said Bree, shaking his mane and stamping his hoof. "An attack in time of peace without defiance sent. But we'll grease his oats for him. We'll be there before he is."
"Can we?"
said Aravis, swinging herself into Hwin's saddle. Shasta wished he could mount like that.
"Bruhoo!" snorted Bree. "Up you get, Shasta. Can we? And with a good start, too."
"He said he was going to start at once," said Aravis.
"That's how humans talk," said Bree. "But you don't get a company of 200 horse and horsemen watered and victualled and armed and saddled and started all in a minute. Now, what's our direction? Due north?"
"No," said Shasta. "I know about that. I've drawn a line. I'll explain later. Bear a bit to our left, both you horses. Ah, here it is."
"Now," said Bree, "all that about galloping for a day and a night, like in stories, can't really be done. It must be walk and trot, but brisk trots and short walks. And whenever we walk, you two humans can slip off and walk too. Now, are you ready, Hwin? Off we go. Narnia and the north."
At first it was delightful. The night had now been going on for so many hours that the sand had almost finished giving back all the sun heat it had received during the day, and the air was cool, fresh and clear. Under the moonlight, the sand, in every direction and as far as they could see, gleamed as if it were smooth water or a great silver tray. Except for the noise of Breeze and Hwin's hoofs, there was not a sound to be heard. Shasta would nearly have fallen asleep if he had not had to dismount and walk every now and then. This seemed to last for hours. Then there came a time when there was no longer any moon. They seemed to ride in the dead darkness for hours and hours. And after that there came a moment when Shasta noticed that he could see Bree's neck and head in front of him a little more clearly than before, and slowly, very slowly, he began to notice the vast grey flatness on every side. It looked absolutely dead, like something in a dead world. And Shasta felt quite terribly tired, and noticed that he was getting cold, and that his lips were dry. And all the time the squeak of the leather, the jingle of the bits, and the noise of the hoofs, not property, property, as it would be on a hard road, but thubbity, thubbity on the dry sand. At last, after hours of riding, far away on his right there came a single long streak of paler grey, low down on the horizon, then a streak of red. It was the morning at last, but without a single bird to sing about it. He was glad of the walking bits now, for he was colder than ever. Then suddenly the sun rose and everything changed in a moment. The grey sand turned yellow and twinkled as if it were strewn with diamonds. On their left, the shadows of Shasta and Hwin and Bree and Aravis, enormously long, raced beside them. The double peak of Mount Pyre, far ahead, flashed in the sunlight, and Shasta saw they were a little out of the course. "A bit left, a bit left," he sang out. Best of all, when you look back, Tashbarn was already small and remote. The tombs were quite invisible, swallowed up in that single, jagged-edged hump which was the city of the Tisrock. Everyone felt better. But not for long. Though Tashbarn looked very far away when they first saw it, it refused to look any further away as they went on. Shasta gave up looking back at it, for it only gave him the feeling that they were not moving at all. Then the light became a nuisance. The glare of the sand made his eyes ache, but he knew he mustn't shut them. He must screw them up and keep on looking ahead at Mount Pyre and shouting out directions. Then came the heat. He noticed it for the first time when he had to dismount and walk. As he slipped down to the sand, the heat from it struck up into his face as if from the opening of an oven door. Next time, it was worse, but the third time, as his bare feet touched the sand, he screamed with pain and got one foot back in the stirrup and the other half over Bree's back before you could have said knife. "Sorry, Bree," he gasped. "I can't walk. It burns my feet."
"Of course," panted Bree. "Should have thought of that myself. Stay on. Can't be helped."
"It's all right for you," said Shasta to Aravis, who was walking beside Hwin. "You've got shoes on."
Aravis said nothing and looked prim. Let's hope she didn't mean to, but she did. On again, trot and walk and trot, jingle, 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 squeak, 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 smell of hot horse, smell of hot self, blinding glare, headache. And nothing at all different for mile after mile. Tashbarn would never look any further away. The mountains would never look any nearer. He felt this had been going on for always. Jingle, 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 squeak, 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 smell of hot horse, smell of hot self. Of course one tried all sorts of games with oneself to try to make the time pass. And of course they were all no good. And one tried very hard not to think of drinks. Iced sherbet in a palace in Tashbarn, clear spring water tinkling with a dark earthy sound, cold, smooth milk just creamy enough and not too creamy. And the harder you tried not to think, the more you thought. At last, there was something different. A mass of rock sticking up out of the sand, about 50 yards long and 30 feet high. It did not cast much shadow, for the sun was now very high, but it cast a little. Into that shade they crowded. There they ate some food and drank a little water. It is not easy giving a horse a drink out of a skin bottle, but Bree and Hwin were clever with their lips. No one had anything like enough. No one spoke. The horses were flecked with foam and their breathing was noisy. The children were pale. After a very short rest they went on again. Same noises, same smells, same glare. Till at last their shadows began to fall on their right, and then got longer and longer, till they seemed to stretch out to the eastern end of the world. Very slowly the sun drew nearer to the western horizon, and now at last he was down, and thank goodness the merciless glare was gone, though the heat coming up from the sand was still as bad as ever. Four pairs of eyes were looking out eagerly for any sign of the valley that Salopad the Raven had spoken about. But mile after mile there was nothing but level sand. And now the day was quite definitely done, and most of the stars were out. And still the horses thundered on, and the children rose and sank in their saddles, miserable with thirst and weariness. Not till the moon had risen did Shasta, in the strange, barking voice of someone whose mouth is perfectly dry, shout out,
"There it is!"
There was no mistaking it now. Ahead, and a little to their right, there was at last a slope. A slope downward, and hummocks of rock on each side. The horses were far too tired to speak, but they swung round toward it, and in a minute or two they were entering the gully. At first it was worse in there than it had been out in the open desert, for there was a breathless stuffiness between the rocky walls and less moonlight. The slope continued steeply downward, and the rocks on either hand rose to the height of cliffs. Then they began to meet vegetation, prickly cactus-like plants and coarse grass of the kind that would prick your fingers. Soon the horse hoofs were falling on pebbles and stones instead of sand. Round every bend of the valley, and it had many bends, they looked eagerly for water. The horses were nearly at the end of their strength now, and Whin, stumbling and panting, was lagging behind Bree. They were almost in despair before at last they came to a little muddiness and a tiny trickle of water through softer and better grass. And the trickle became a brook, and the brook became a stream with bushes on each side, and the stream became a river, and there came, after more disappointments than I could possibly describe, a moment when Shasta, who had been in a kind of doze, suddenly realized that Bree had stopped and found himself slipping off. Before them, a little cataract of water poured into a broad pool, and both the horses were already in the pool with their heads down, drinking, drinking, drinking.
"Oh, oh!"
said Shasta, and plunged in. It was about up to his knees, and stooped his head right into the cataract. It was perhaps the loveliest moment in his life. It was about 10 minutes later when all four of them, the two children wet nearly all over, came out and began to notice their surroundings. The moon was now high enough to peep down into the valley. There was soft grass on both sides of the river, and beyond the grass, trees and bushes sloped up to the bases of the cliffs. There must have been some wonderful flowering shrubs hidden in that shadowy undergrowth, for the whole glade was full of the coolest and most delicious smells. And out of the darkest recess among the trees, there came a sound Shasta had never heard before. A nightingale. Everyone was much too tired to speak or to eat. The horses, without waiting to be unsaddled, lay down at once. So did Aravis and Shasta. About 10 minutes later, the careful Whin said,
"But we mustn't go to sleep. We've got to keep ahead of that rabidash."
"No," said Bree very slowly. "Mustn't go to sleep. Just a little rest."
Shasta knew, for a moment, that they would all go to sleep if he didn't get up and do something about it, and felt that he ought to. In fact, he decided that he would get up and persuade them to go on. But presently, not yet. Not just yet. Very soon the moon shone, and the nightingale sang, over two horses and two human children, all fast asleep. It was Aravis who awoke first. The sun was already high in the heavens, and the cool morning hours were already wasted.
"It's my fault,"
she said to herself furiously as she jumped up and began rousing the others.
"One wouldn't expect horses to keep awake after a day's work like that, even if they can talk. And of course that boy wouldn't. He's had no decent training. But I ought to have known better."
The others were dazed and stupid with the heaviness of their sleep.
"Hey-ho, bruh," said Bree. "Been sleeping in my saddle, eh? I'll never do that again. Most uncomfortable."
"Oh, come on, come on," said Aravis. "We've lost half the morning already. There isn't a moment to spare."
"A fellow's got to have a mouthful of grass," said Bree.
"I'm afraid we can't wait," said Aravis.
"What's the terrible hurry?" said Bree. "We've crossed the desert, haven't we?"
"But we're not in Arkenland yet," said Aravis, "and we've got to get there before Rabadash."
"Oh, we must be miles ahead of him," said Bree. "Haven't we been coming a shorter way? Didn't that raven friend of yours say this was a shortcut, Shasta?"
"'He didn't say anything about shorter,' answered Chester. "'He only said better, because you got to a river this way. "'If the oasis is due north of Tashban, then I'm afraid this may be longer.'
"'Well, I can't go on without a snack,' said Bree. "'Take my bridle off, Chester.'
"'Please,' said Wynne, very shyly. "'I feel just like Bree that I can't go on. "'But when horses have humans with spurs and things on their backs, "'aren't they often made to go on when they're feeling like this? "'And then they find they can. "'I mean, oughtn't we be able to do even more, now that we're free? "'It's all for Narnia.'
"'I think, ma'am,' said Bree very crushingly, "'that I know a little more about campaigns and forced marches "'and what a horse can stand than you do.' "'To this Wynne made no answer, being, like most highly bred mares, "'a very nervous and gentle person who was easily put down. "'In reality she was quite right, "'and if Bree had had a tarkan on his back at that moment to make him go on, "'he would have found that he was good for several hours hard going. "'But one of the worst results of being a slave and being forced to do things "'is that when there is no one to force you any more, "'you find you have almost lost the power of forcing yourself. "'So they had to wait while Bree had a snack and a drink, "'and, of course, Wynne and the children had a snack and a drink, too. "'It must have been nearly 11 o'clock in the morning "'before they finally got going again. "'And even then Bree took things much more gently than yesterday. "'It was really Wynne, though she was the weaker or more tired of the two, "'who set the pace. "'The valley itself, with its brown, cool river, and grass and moss and wild flowers and rhododendrons, was such a pleasant place that it made you want to ride slowly. Chapter 10 The Hermit of the Southern March. After they had ridden for several hours down the valley, it widened out, and they could see what was ahead of them. The river which they had been following here joined a broader river, wide and turbulent, which flowed from their left to their right toward the east. Beyond this new river, a delightful country rose gently in low hills, ridge beyond ridge, to the northern mountains themselves. To the right there were rocky pinnacles, one or two of them with snow clinging to the ledges. To the left, pine-clad slopes, frowning cliffs, narrow gorges, and blue peaks stretched away as far as the eye could reach. Shasta could no longer make out Mount Pyre. Straight ahead the mountain range sank to a wooded saddle, which of course must be the pass from Arkenland into Narnia.
"'Brew! The north! The green north!' neighed Bree.
And certainly the lower hills looked greener and fresher than anything that Aravis and Shasta, with their southern-bred eyes, had ever imagined. Spirits rose as they clattered down to the water's meet of the two rivers. The eastern flowing river, which was pouring from the higher mountains at the western end of the range, was far too swift and too broken with rapids for them to think of swimming it. But after some casting about, up and down the bank, they found a place shallow enough to wade. The roar and clatter of water, the great swirl against the horses' fetlocks, the cool, stirring air and the darting dragonflies, filled Shasta with a strange excitement.
"'Friends, we are in Arkenland,' said Bree proudly as he splashed and churned his way out on the northern bank. "'I think that river we've just crossed is called the Winding Arrow.'
"'I hope we're in time,' murmured Wynne.
Then they began going up, slowly and zigzagging a good deal, for the hills were steep. It was all open park-like country with no roads or houses in sight. Scattered trees, never thick enough to be a forest, were everywhere. Shasta, who had lived all his life in an almost treeless grassland, had never seen so many or so many kinds. If you had been there, you would probably have known, he didn't, that he was seeing oaks, beeches, silver birches, rowans, and sweet chestnuts. Rabbits scurried away in every direction as they advanced, and presently they saw a whole herd of fallow deer making off among the trees.
"'Isn't it simply glorious?' said Aravis.
At the first ridge, Shasta turned in the saddle and looked back. There was no sign of Tashban. The desert, unbroken except by the narrow green crack down which they had travelled down, spread to the horizon.
"'Hello,' he said suddenly. "'What's that?'
"'What's what?' said Bree, turning round. Wynne and Aravis did the same.
"'That,' said Shasta, pointing. "'It looks like smoke. Is it a fire?'
"'Sandstorm, I should say,'
said Bree.
"Not much wind to raise it," said Aravis.
"Oh," exclaimed Wyn, "look, there are things flashing in it. Look, they're helmets and armor, and it's moving, moving this way." "By Tash," said Aravis, "it's the army. It's Rabadash." "Of course it is," said Wyn. "Just what I was afraid of. Quick, we must get to Anvar before it."
And without another word, she whisked round and began galloping north. Bree tossed his head and did the same.
"Come on, Bree, come on,"
yelled Aravis over her shoulder. The race was very grueling for the horses. As they topped each ridge, they found another valley and another ridge beyond it. And though they knew they were going in more or less the right direction, no one knew how far it was to Anvard. From the top of the second ridge, Shasta looked back again. Instead of a dust cloud well out in the desert, he now saw a black moving mass, rather like ants, on the far bank of the winding arrow. They were doubtless looking for a ford.
"They're on the river," he yelled wildly. "Quick, quick," shouted Aravis. "We might as well not have come at all if we don't reach Anvard in time. Gallop, Bree, gallop! Remember, you're a warhorse!"
It was all Shasta could do to prevent himself from shouting out similar instructions. But he thought, "The poor chap's doing all he can already," and held his tongue. And certainly both horses were doing, if not all they could, all they thought they could, which is not quite the same thing. Bree had caught up with Wyn, and they thundered side by side over the turf. It didn't look as if Wyn could possibly keep it up much longer. At that moment, everyone's feelings were completely alerted by a sound from behind. It was not the sound they had been expecting to hear, the noises of hoofs and jingling armour mixed, perhaps, with Calormene battle cries. Yet Shasta knew it at once. It was the same snarling roar he had heard that moonlit night when they first met Aravis and Wyn. Bree knew it, too. His eyes gleamed red, and his ears lay flat back on his skull. And Bree now discovered that he had not really been going as fast, not quite as fast as he could. Shasta felt the change at once. Now they were really going all out. In a few seconds they were well ahead of Wyn.
"It's not fair," thought Shasta. "I did think we'd be safe from lions here."
He looked over his shoulder. Everything was only too clear. A huge, tawny creature, its body low to the ground, like a cat streaking across the lawn to a tree when a strange dog has got into the garden, was behind them. And it was nearer every second and half-second. He looked forward again and saw something which he did not take in nor even think about. Their way was barred by a smooth green wall about 10 feet high. In the middle of that wall there was a gate, open. In the middle of the gateway stood a tall man, dressed, down to his bare feet, in a robe coloured like autumn leaves, leaning on a straight staff. His beard fell almost to his knees. Shasta saw all this in a glance and looked back again. The lion had almost got Wyn now. It was making snaps at her hind legs, and there was no hope now in her foam-flecked, wide-eyed face.
"Stop!" bellowed Shasta in Bree's ear. "Must go back! Must help!"
Bree always said afterward that he never heard or never understood this, and as he was in general a very truthful horse, we must accept his word. Shasta slipped his feet out of the stirrups, slid both his legs over on the left side, hesitated for one hideous hundredth of a second, and jumped. It hurt horribly, and nearly winded him. But before he knew how it hurt him, he was staggering back to help Aravis. He had never done anything like this in his life before, and hardly knew why he was doing it now. One of the most terrible noises in the world, a horse's scream, broke from Wyn's lips. Aravis was stooping low over Wyn's neck, and seemed to be trying to draw her sword. And now all three, Aravis, Wyn, and the lion, were almost on top of Shasta. Before they reached him, the lion rose on its hind legs, larger than you would have believed a lion could be, and jabbed at Aravis with its right paw. Shasta could see all the terrible claws extended. Aravis screamed and reeled in the saddle. The lion was tearing her shoulders. Shasta, half mad with horror, managed to lurch toward the brute. He had no weapon, not even a stick or a stone. He shouted out, idiotically, at the lion, as one would at a dog, "Go home! Go home!" For a fraction of a second he was staring right into its wide-open, raging mouth. Then, to his utter astonishment, the lion, still on its hind legs, checked itself suddenly, turned head over heels, picked itself up, and rushed away. Shasta did not for a moment suppose it had gone for good. He turned and raced for the gate in the green wall, which now for the first time he remembered seeing. Huynh, stumbling and nearly fainting, was just entering the gate. Atavis still kept her seat, but her back was covered with blood.
"Come in, my daughter,"